This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA plus community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
You can hear us live on Joy 94.9 Saturday afternoon via the live stream at joy.org.au/listen-live. Or tune your wireless in Melbourne to 94.9 FM.
1, 2, 3, 4!
Use it, break it, fix it, trash it, change it, nail it, grade it, change it, point it to me, press it, snap it, work it, quick, erase it, write it, cut it, paste it, save it, load it, check it, quick, rewrite it, plug it, play it, burn it, rip it, drag it, drop it.
You are listening to Technogaze, where we gaze into the world of consumer electronics, gadgets, and technology. I'm Michael, and in the studio with me today is Nicole.
Hi.
How's your week been?
Oh, it's been a busy week.
It has, hasn't it?
Busy week for technology, too.
Lots and lots of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And joining us also is our resident indie game developer, Luke.
Hello.
How are you?
Oh, not too bad. How's everyone?
Very well.
We're very well. Tell us, what are you working on at the moment?
It's been a pretty good week. I'm making a game at the moment, gay themed, of course. But it's been quite a bewildering week for technology. So much has happened, wouldn't you say?
A lot has happened, and a lot has happened in the last few days as well. So, and in fact, the things that we're going to be looking at is, of course, Apple, because the watch has hit the streets, and many people are wearing it. It's out in the wild for the first time. So we've had some.
I still don't
feedback.
Have one yet. I'm working on it.
Have you ordered one?
No.
Well, that's the first step.
Well, it is, but it's working out what you want too.
Get one of everything. What's the expensive one called? Is it the Elite?
Something like that.
The gold one, $17,000 or $20,000 one?
Worthless within 2 years. There you go.
It could be a collector's item. Who knows? So we're going to be looking at those impressions of the watch. And finally, somebody has thought up of a good use for a drone.
Yay.
Beyond all the other uses that have been. Sweden's using open source licensing for more than software, which is quite an interesting story. And Russia's homophobia laws have targeted Apple. Also, under the heading of security and transparency, we're going to look at some new offerings from Telstra and Google. And, of course, we are going to talk about some game-related things, aren't we, Luke?
Yes, looking forward to it.
And I'm looking forward to it as well, because you can educate us. Because I am very lack of knowledge around games.
Well, we'll give you a starter kit.
Good.
Yep.
That'll
Fantastic.
Be great.
So don't forget that you can contact us on 1300JOY949 or 0427JOY949, or you can email us on onair@joy.org.au. We also have our social space as well, so Twitter at Technogaze, TechnoGaze, or on Facebook, TechnogazeJOY949.
That's right, and our Facebook likers have liked us again this week.
Yes, we've got a few likes, so thank you and welcome to Berna, Shalom, Phoebe, Paul, Joe, Nick, Randy, Wazim, Dwayne, Lee, Chloe, Danny, and a new one, Nikita, for today.
Lovely. So let's press on with Apple. The quarterly earnings figures have come out, and I think Apple are very happy and market analysts are very happy. Because sales and profitability figures were higher than expected. And in fact, Apple is saying that on the strong iPhone sales, both in China, UK and India. And I think it's probably, it's strange because I know Apple in the early days, like many other companies, was very much US focused. But I think that they're getting a lot of revenue, if not the bulk of their revenue, from overseas markets.
And it's amazing turnaround from, you know, 20 years ago where Apple was the one most likely to fall over, you know, and now all of a sudden, are they the most valuable company on the planet or close to it?
It's close
unbelievable.
To it.
Yeah, if they're not the most, very, very close.
Yeah. And China's a big part of that, as you said, yeah.
And I think you see that in the way that they market their products, you know, with the gold iPhone, which is, you know, obviously to the Chinese market. Yes, and when you talk about what Apple was like 20 years ago, then I kick myself for not buying shares.
Well, the benefit of hindsight is a wonderful thing.
Yes. But,
I mean, I did read an amusing thing quite a while ago that if you, instead of buying an Apple computer in like 1998, you had spent the money on Apple shares, you'd be a millionaire now.
True.
So it was like $2,000 investment or something.
Oh,
so,
okay. Are you rubbing it in? Are you?
but did you get enjoyment out of the Apple that you bought? So
I did, but not as much as I would have got out of $1 million. Although, take away capital gains and all of that. But still, you know, who's going to look a gift horse in the mouth? Apple also said that their Mac and Apple Store sales grew, so not just iPhone, but sales of the iPad continued to decline, down another 14% this year. So is this the end of the tablet?
I don't think it's the end. I think it just needs to change in its own way. Maybe just not just the size of it, but adding a little bit more to it.
Okay.
Yeah, a little pause before an upswing. I mean, I assume the iPod also has probably not had a great... Do they even still make the iPod?
You can still buy iPods.
You can still buy iPods?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But just they're a little bit different now. They're a bit smaller now, so rather than big clunky ones that you used to get.
Well, I guess, yeah, for something, the bigger ones, you may as well get iPhone-type size.
True.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what is the future of the iPad, because, of course, it was Steve Jobs that famously said, I'll never make a device that's going to be used in the toilet. So
that didn't happen, did it?
Now, the watch, people have been wearing it.
Yes, they have. But there seems to be a technical, possibly, not quite sure because we
teething
don't know.
Problem.
But there's some teething problems.
Yeah, and what have they called this one? It's another gate type, you know, because of course everybody likes the word.
Tattoo gate? Hashtag?
Yes. Okay, what's happening with tattoo gate?
There seems to be an issue with wearing an Apple Watch if you've got tattoos. So as you're sort of going along wearing the watch, it seems to turn off. And you have to then, of course, take it off and put it back on so that it resets again. So it seems
because
to be blocking the light.
There are sensors underneath on the back of the phone.
That's right.
That detect your heart rate and the electrical activity on your skin and everything. And the tattoo ink.
Yeah, it's blocking that sort of sensor to actually activate the light to penetrate through the skin.
So the watch thinks that it's not on your
correct,
wrist.
Correct, yeah. So there's been quite a number of videos over Twitter and people actually demonstrating, look, this is actually happening. So...
Now, it's not on lightly tattooed people. It's on people who've got some fairly dark tattoos on their skin.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. So it's reminiscent about there was a problem with one of the web cameras a while ago.
Yeah, the Swedish engineers with their webcam, and it hilariously wouldn't track black people's faces because I guess it had only been tested on white people.
Yeah.
And... that there was a great YouTube video going around calling my webcam is racist.
That's right.
And it does. It is very reminiscent of that. Like just not enough sort of real world testing.
Yeah. I know, but how would you even consider that as a thought pattern? Unless, of course, one of the people on the engineering team was heavily tattooed, in which case they may have, you know, found it out a bit earlier. But still, it's one of these things that's really hard to test until you're in the wild.
It's one of those things. I've been reading lots of articles about the fact that they're saying, wouldn't Apple have employees that have tattoos and potentially test? But it's one of those things that you have to research and market and find out whether, you know, things like that would actually occur, and obviously they have.
It wouldn't surprise me if, you know, at the Apple compound, there was some rule about you're not allowed to have tattoos to work there, or you can only eat kale, or, you know, it's just, on one hand, the company's got a really cool reputation, but also it does have a little bit of a cultish reputation. And
about it. It just shows what the advantage of having a diverse workforce is, because if, you know, they would have had a fully diverse workforce that was involved in the testing, they probably would have discovered this earlier.
But how could you ever anticipate that, you know?
Yeah,
it's hilarious, though. Well, it's my favourite iWatch story.
I think one of the things is that it just pushes Apple out there even further, doesn't it? It gets the conversation going, gets people testing the product. So
yeah, true.
So like, in a way, it's good publicity as well.
So what, all publicity is good publicity?
Yeah, well, you know, for Apple, it's one of the, it's a good thing.
It probably is. Now, Qantas has also hit a bit of turbulence with their watch app. haven't they?
That's something that never should have got out of the lab, I guess, as well. So,
well, yeah. Yeah, they obviously didn't test it in real-world situation. Mm. Well, part of the issue, they said, is they couldn't physically get hold of...
Sorry, well, what's
the problem?
Yep,
okay,
yep.
So what it is the Watch app works in conjunction with the phone app, and you can have your boarding pass downloaded onto your phone as a QR code. But if you've got the watch, it actually puts it on the watch, and the idea is you put your hand underneath the boarding pass scanner and it will scan your hand, so you don't need to pull your watch out of your pocket, your phone out of your pocket and put it underneath the reader. Except nobody actually tried to put a wrist with a watch under the scanner because there's not enough height between the top of the scanner and the base of the scanner.
Mm-hmm. The first person that found that out, I wonder if they missed their flight that day.
Well, all the other passengers queuing behind them wouldn't have been happy, would they?
Well, it makes you think, because a lot of them do use their iPhone, because you can scale it up and you can scan it properly.
Yes.
And so you've got enough screen to do that, but on a wrist, you can't really scale up, can you?
No.
100 years ago, watching someone on a penny farthing go past, going, it's the future, and everyone's a bit like, yeah, whatever. And then the person blocking the line with the phone going, no, it's the future.
To have a missed aeroplane. The iFixit crowd, the people that tear down new products and show you how to fix them if you can, have torn apart the watch, and basically the only two things that you can fix or replace are the battery and the glass at the front.
Mm.
And the whole internal mechanism, if you try to pull it apart, it gets damaged and you have to throw it out. Now, it's not cheap to fix the watch. You can take out an AppleCare Plus plan for $99 that will cover for two accidental breakages, but you do have to pay a fee per service for each one. But if you don't have AppleCare, the cost to replace the glass, I believe, is around about $329.
Wow, so it's like double. So you get the watch plus...
Because the watch is $400-something, I think,
yeah.
For the cheap one. Yes. Anyway... See, the demand is exceeding the supply, so Apple must be happy, I guess.
They must be.
Yes. Now, we have, coming up next, one of the best drone stories I've heard in a while.
Technogaze.
You are listening to Technogaze on Joy 94.9. And we are going to be droning on. Oh, it's the day of bad puns, isn't it?
I love drones. We did talk about drones last week.
We did, and we tend to talk about drones a lot. And usually, you know, we've brought stories about selfie drone, porn drone.
Porn drone.
Yes, the drone that will shoot beautifully artistic porn from a height and as it goes through the forest. And very, very good. But this one's a little bit more practical.
It actually plants.
What?
Trees.
Yeah. It's amazing, this little drone. It goes through, and they're saying they can plant 1 billion trees a year with it. It's a lot of trees.
Yes. Where, though? Like...
Well, the idea is that in areas where forests have been lost and they want to restore forests, one of the biggest impediments to doing that is obviously access, because they can be quite rugged to get into, and the manpower that you need to do it. So the founder of the company is an ex-NASA engineer, and he said that with the drone, it can plant 36,000 trees a day, and at about 15% of the cost of traditional manual methods, which is pretty good.
That would be amazing to see. I assume you can get a couple going at once, and it must be like a bit like a bee colony. They just sort of fly in, pick up the seeds, fly out, deposit them.
Well, in fact, the way that they deposit the seeds is quite smart. They don't just randomly drop them. They do a scout for the correct area. So it's all human-driven, so somebody has to pilot it. And then when they discover an area that they want to seed, it goes down, hovers about 2 to 3 metres above the ground, and it fires a pod that contains some pre-germinated seeds covered in some sort of nutritious hydrogel into the ground. The pod sinks into the ground, and that's how the trees are planted.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I wonder how they get watered. Will a drone come along and water?
Well,
you know,
I assume that in forestry areas there's sufficient water to, you know, to feed the plants.
Well, we have robot vacuums. It's only a matter of time till we have robot gardeners.
Possibly.
You know, I'm looking forward to that. My garden's a bit overgrown.
This terrain's a little bit hillier than your back garden.
It wouldn't be Roomba shaped. It'd fly.
Oh, I see. You're a drone gardener.
Yeah.
You probably want a humanoid one, though.
Oh, Well, this is back onto the drone porn, right?
Oh, I'm getting totally confused. Yes. Anyway, apparently this is not as good as hand sewing, but based on the volume that you can get through, it's a pretty good alternative. Now, Amazon's also been experimenting with drones before and to deliver parcels, and I think they're probably not quite where they want to be because of they're trialling a new delivery mechanism in Germany, in Munich, in fact. And they're working with DHL and Audi to pilot delivery of packages into your car boot.
I know. I was watching something online, and pretty much what it does is that you only have that one key access for the boot to open. So you get your delivery, you organise it, the person comes along, they opens your boot, puts in the required stock that you've paid for, and off it goes. Or you can return it the same way as well. So I thought that was quite interesting.
And I guess they're addressing security implications of this by having this ability to have a one-time remote opening, which disappears the moment the boot is locked. Now, they've had to specially fit Audi vehicles for the test and also put in some special tracking software, well, probably hardware, in fact, rather than software, to allow the driver, because the driver knows approximately where the car is, and then they'll track it to the actual spot and pop the boot and put it in. But it does make sense that if, you know, why do you want to walk to the post office or even somebody delivering to your office where you just drop it in the boot, take it home, and then enjoy your purchase?
The question is, would you use a service like that here?
Well, I don't know. I've noticed that there are some companies, I think it's Coles at least, have had some storage lockers near petrol stations where you can get your supermarket shopping delivered into a locker and you can pick it up from there. So it does make sense because there are a lot of people who aren't at home during the day to receive packages, and maybe they're not allowed to receive packages at work.
Mm.
So this is somewhere in between where it can be delivered securely, either a locker or your car boot, and off you go. Wouldn't it be bad if they actually chose the wrong car and got into that?
Or if you're driving down the freeway and it decides to do delivery then, that would be pretty cool.
Or you have the little delivery man roaring up behind you, I've got your package. Yes. So it'll be interesting to see then what are the requirements on car manufacturers to allow this to actually happen in the practical world.
It seems slightly impractical, I think. Like, it just seems it'd be easier to drop it off at your house or at a predetermined location.
I think it is today, but in the future when we have connected cars, and connected cars are coming, and you do get the app on your phone to do things to it, it doesn't reply in Australia, so we think, well, why do you need it? But to at least turn the car on when it's, you know, minus 10 degrees outside to warm up a little bit, you know, you would turn it on remotely and you can pop the boot as well. So it might even be the case where the delivery person rings you up and says, I'm here, you pop the boot, and they put it in and they shut it.
But isn't it, I mean, to me the debate about driverless cars at the moment is whether you'll own a car or whether it'll be an autonomous fleet where you summon a vehicle on demand. And so maybe Audi's doing this to kind of incentivize owning a car still.
Possibly. Mm-hmm. And also push the brand.
Yes. Oh, well, very, very much to push the brand, because I'll get lots of people talking about it and watching the YouTube videos. But yeah, I think in some ways, Luke, you're right. Car companies are going to have to find ways to remain relevant in an era where most people probably don't care whether they own a car or not.
Especially in the cities.
Yes. You know, yeah.
Where they're actively discouraging it. So. Mm.
And it depends on the type of driver that you are, whether you do it for enjoyment of driving, whether you just want to get from point A to point B.
That's true.
Interesting future, in fact, with cars. And we had a little chat with the Fender Bender guys about a year ago now about this. We probably should revisit it at some stage.
Oh, driverless cars?
Yeah.
Mm, that'd be interesting.
Oh, just imagining the future and being able to summon your car. I was reading a book where basically the character sort of drove up somewhere and then sent the car home.
That'd be great.
I plan on living in my driverless car.
Do you?
Just take me to Brisbane, wake me up in 7 days or something.
It's called a caravan.
Oh.
Sweden are using open source licensing for something other than software.
Humans. Oh, no, sorry. I think I better say that right.
Yeah. Go on. A little bit more detail, please.
DNA. Yes. To be precise.
Yeah, what are they doing?
Well, basically, they're creating DNA sequences. So, they've published something called Human Protein Atlas. So it was their first open source release in 2012. It's basically painting patenting human genes.
Yeah, well, they're sequencing the human genome and with this current project, and unlike some other companies that will charge you for access to the work that they've done to discover it, they've released it under the Creative Commons license, which typically you see for open source software projects, saying that anybody can use it if as long as you comply with the licensing terms. So it's available to anybody who's scientifically minded that way.
Creative Commons license and the GPL and the LGPL and even the OpenBSD license, I honestly think they'll go down as some of the greatest inventions of the 20th century. Just yes. This idea that it's sharing work, but there's still protections for it. It's,
right. Mm-hmm.
And it's using the copyright system to enforce sharing. It's a really beautiful, simple idea, and it holds up in the court everywhere it's tested, and it's just great to see it being applied to more and more fields.
And
so.
And beyond just the software field, do you know the differences between the different licenses?
The main two that I use, that I encounter in the software world is the GPL mm-hmm. and the OpenBSD, and the GPL is a lot more stricter, but in my mind a lot more free, because it says you can borrow that, you can use this work. You don't have to, but if you want to use our work, you then have to share what you've modifications mm-hmm. you've done. Whereas the OpenBSD is a lot more freer, and it says you can just use it.
Oh, okay.
So companies can take an OpenBSD code and lock it down because they don't have to share it.
They don't have to put it back in again.
Yes, whereas the GPL is, you can only use my code if you're willing to keep sharing.
Do you prefer the GPL?
Oh, absolutely, mm-hmm. absolutely. Because there's a lot of unscrupulous people out there.
Mm. Mm.
Yes, because whatever value add you put onto it, you give back to the community that way.
Yes, and you never force anyone to use the code. No, they're choosing to use it.
Yes, yeah. That's right. Hmm. Yeah, because it may be very specific for a particular application, but it's back in public domain again. Now, I was surprised. I hadn't heard of this before, but America's also got an open source genome project called ENCODE, where they're doing something similar. And this has all come about because the ability to sequence DNA is much easier, and what used to take years to do now takes months.
Wow.
So they've only done one part of the DNA, and it'll take them quite a while, I think, to get through it all. Mm. So it must be a big task. Apparently, 2 years ago, the US Supreme Court ruled that you can't patent human genes, and they said that naturally occurring DNA segments are a product of nature, and just because they've been isolated doesn't mean that they can be patented. Of course, this leaves the door open for those bits of DNA that are man-made at some stage into the future.
Mm. Well, that'll be interesting.
Yes, that'll be very interesting.
The first time you get a DNA injection and you'll be like,
What did you just give me?
Yes, yes.
Maybe a humanoid will do that one. You never know.
Some, AI DNA?
AI DNA, yeah. Too many sci-fis.
Indeed. Yes, we've all got some vivid imagination. We are going to be looking at Russia and their anti-gay laws next. 27 minutes past five, and you're listening to Michael, Nicole and Luke on Technogaze. Russia, they brought in the famous homophobic anti-gay law to protect innocent children. And now they're accusing Apple of distributing gay propaganda to minors under those particular laws.
And it's all through Apple's U2 album.
That's right. So last year, half of the world complained because of the spam from U2 when there's an iTunes update and you were forced to download this U2 album. And apparently the cover artwork included the band's drummer embracing his adult son and both are shirtless. The photo's a visual metaphor for the album and its theme of how holding on to your own innocence is a lot harder than holding on to someone else's. But a Russian Duma deputy disagrees and he believes that it promotes sex between men and has referred it to the Attorney General.
Hmm.
They are really hell-bent on enforcing this law, aren't they?
They are a little bit, but to be honest, I don't know why there's so much controversy when it comes to this. It's simply, okay, the album was pushed out. You probably didn't want the download, but I'm not quite sure why they would sort of come on this level.
They're jumping on any single image that possibly connotates anything.
Possibly connotates.
Yes.
Yeah. I think it's Russia's version of Stop the Boats. you know, it's just this slogan that the politicians can resort to, like stop the gays sort of thing.
Well, it's appealing to the mass population because when things aren't good at home, then if you can latch onto one thing that people may feel uncomfortable about or something that you can grow into a bigger thing and, you know, find a scapegoat, then you distract attention.
They're foolish to put those laws in place because they've set themselves up in opposition to something that's just going to hammer away at them until they back down. Like,
yeah, I don't know. Well, do you think they'll back down? Because, you know, there's been a sort of boycott of Russia, a semi-boycott, but I don't know how effective that's been.
But there are gay people all over Russia, and it's going to follow, I mean, I assume, the same path that's followed pretty much everywhere else. They're just kind of going to, you know, become prouder and prouder, and then their families are going to come on board. And
either that or they're going to be stomped upon. So it's...
Well, hopefully not.
Well, hopefully not, and hopefully the world can bring some pressure to Russia to try and reverse these laws. But it's, you know, when the whole world is generally changing and becoming more open and more accepting, it's very difficult to see one country going backwards.
True.
And using every avenue to push what they see as the right path. I wonder what Apple's response is going to be, because this only broke the news, I think, yesterday or the day before. So Apple may have
something worse than a U2 album. I think they've already done their worst.
Two U2 albums.
Yeah.
Yes. Now, also on the security side, Google's got a new feature that allows you to view your entire search history.
Yes.
I don't know if you guys have had a look at it.
Yes, I have.
You had a look as well? Yeah.
Had a look and I was like, oh, did I really actually look at that the other day? You can actually log in and you can go through your settings and you can actually see your history from each day that you've actually done a particular task online. So you can certainly download the history or you can delete it too as well.
Yeah, if you want to clear it. The what is interesting is I went through the exactly same thought process as you, saying, oh, did I go there? Oh, yeah, that's right. I remember doing that. Did you remember the count of number of Google searches you've performed?
I don't know. I just went through this whole list. I went, wow, I'm too much on the internet.
17,410. That's my count.
Wow. I use DuckDuckGo.
Oh, okay. So you'd have no history, hopefully.
Yes. Well, some history. I do, you know, you can't avoid Google.
That's right. Yeah. Especially if your browser points to it as default and you do it in the search bar, in the URL bar, then it just will go do it. The other interesting thing is it shows you what the links and what images you clicked on. So, you know, my most clicked on link is speedtest.net. And that's because
that tells a story.
It does tell a story. It tells a story of bad memory because for years I could not remember the URL to test the speed of my internet connection. And then the top site, I was a little bit worried, it is Wikipedia.
Oh, that's all right.
So
I know someone out there has probably looked at their search history and the top link will be www.google.com. That's the thing they're searching for the most, and they'll never put two to two together.
Yes, that's right. My third one was Google, but anyway. if anybody's interested, the URL is history.google.com, and you have to log in with your Google account, so you need a Google account.
Yes.
And as Nicole said, you can download it. It does give you a warning about downloading it, saying that if you have it in a file, that if somebody gets access to it, so don't download it on a public computer, someone gets access to it, they can see all of your, a lot of personal information. So it's fairly revealing. Now, Telstra, I think you told me about this story, Luke.
Yes, because a fellow by the name of Will Ockenden, I believe his name is, on Ockenden on Twitter during the week. He finally got his metadata from Telstra. For years, they had said, we're not providing it, but they changed their policy on it, and he requested it. And just through the week, he was tweeting about it, and it was quite eye-opening for a lot of people. So,
to see the volume of data that was in, the type of data?
Yes. I think the thing he was most shocked at is your phone pings your local phone tower every minute or so.
Yep.
And Telstra had a year's worth of that. So a year's worth of the location of his phone every minute.
Yeah, within a sort of a bandwidth of the tower.
Yes. Yeah. And he was like, oh, that seems a lot of information. And of course, that is now mandatory collected on everybody. Mm-hmm. So
it is. But I guess there's a very good reason why they collect and they store it for that long is for billing purposes, because I think Telstra are obligated to keep that. So if you do query your bill, and it can be up to a year later, that they can say, well, hang on, we could tell on this date and this time this was the vicinity that you were in, and it's not just one reading, it's, you know, 1,000 readings.
Well, data retention to provide a service to you is perfectly fine in my mind.
Yes.
It's, if that data is being retained to be used against you, potentially, that's a bit of a problem. So,
but there is a cost so with everything. So it's $25 for a simple request. But if you do want something a little bit more detailed, then it's on an hourly charge.
But Telstra did say this is the same mechanism that they're using to charge law enforcement agencies when they request the same thing.
And good on Telstra being more transparent about it.
Yes,
you know, it's very good.
Because part of the problem with data retention is people are like, we don't actually know what's happening with this data. So,
and we don't know what data is there as well. We've got, you know, like Will found out, there's all this information that he didn't expect. Mm. Now, he probably is not going to change his pattern of behaviour, but it's nice to know what's being collected. Mm. And as an end user, you don't know, you don't understand, and you, to some degree, you probably don't care because you don't understand what the ramifications may be of having this. But it's a huge amount of data. Telstra, when they changed their mind, said that they'll be giving you, as in us, access to the metadata related to you so that we provide we would provide in response to a lawful request without a warrant, with a warrant from a law enforcement agency. We believe that if the police can ask for information relating to you, you should be able to as well. So, yeah, in the aid of transparency, I think that's a great move.
Definitely, for sure.
I wonder how many people are going to be doing it.
Who knows?
$25.
But then there will be data collected of that as well to analyse. And
the people who are asking for their metadata.
Straight on the list.
Yes, indeed.
Now, it's metadata.
Metadata, yeah.
Oh, that's too meta for me. A cynical person might say this is a way of Telstra to raise some more revenue.
Possibly.
But do they need more revenue?
Always. Oh. Always. It's like cupboard space. No matter how much you've got. And disk space, no matter how much you've got, you fill it and you always need more.
And that's with life, isn't it?
It is indeed. Now, what else do we have? Choice. Australian consumer advocacy group Choice has said that some VPNs could be blocked under some new copyright law that's being considered by the Senate. That if this new law passes, copyright owners would be able to apply for a federal court order which would require ISPs to block overseas sites whose primary purpose is infringing copyright or facilitating the infringement of copyright. So, in itself, it sounds relatively harmless, but they are targeting those websites that offer a VPN service so that you can, get copyright material illegally. But I wonder what else they're going to catch in the process, as in stop people from accessing in the process.
Well, this is a classic case of they're trying like legislative solutions to technological problems or technological solutions to legislative problems. It's sort of a, you know, it's going around in a circle. So,
yes.
You know, they'll ban websites, but then people switch to VPNs, but then they can ban VPNs or license them, because I doubt you'll be able to really get rid of virtual private networks because they're so essential to just the functioning of businesses. But then, you know, license them or whatever, but then they'll find some other way around it. And, you know, the best solution to a technological problem is a technological solution, like making a service that's as competitive to torrenting, for example.
Yes.
You know, yeah. So it just seems to me that they're wasting their time pretty much and just causing a lot of hassle, and it's not going to work.
There have been cases in the past where websites have been taken down improperly. And when I say improperly, instead of removing the DNS entry, the entry that basically does the lookup for the website name and gives an IP address, they have blocked the whole IP address without considering the fact that that one IP address can serve many, many websites. Mm. So in the States, from time to time, you had cases where dozens and dozens of legitimate websites would go down to be replaced by an FBI banner saying, you know, this is being blocked for infringement, blah, 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 when in fact they were just blocking one of the tenants, if you like, on that IP address and then blocked the whole lot. So,
well, the people doing it don't really know. It's so hard to be on top of it all. Like, I know Parliament House during the week, Kevin Rudd's website was blocked.
Oh, really?
That went around on Twitter as well. Just people had great fun with that. You know, and the same people that are blocking Kevin Rudd's website will be the ones deciding which websites will be blocked for the rest of us. It doesn't inspire me with much confidence.
No. The Australian Copyright Council says that using VPNs or geoblocks is not allowed without the permission of the owner. And this is after Choice said that there are about 684,000 Australian homes that use VPNs to bypass geoblocks. So geoblocking is geoblocking software allows you to use a VPN to connect onto a service and then access the content that it normally wouldn't be allowed from, let's say, Australia. Mm-hmm. So famously, the US Hulu service, yes, which I think was free, but I'm not sure if it's free anymore.
Well, you can't really access it because when you go onto the website, it tells you you're in the wrong region. So,
but if you subscribe to some geo-blocking software and you use a VPN, it comes out into the right region, and as far as the site is concerned, you are legitimate and you're allowed to use it.
So you set up a fake... Well, not a fake. You set up a point in the US to relay the data to you. So, so your US computer connects to Hulu. Mm.
Yeah, that's right.
And so it's perfectly legitimate.
Well, according to the Australian Copyright Council, they say, no, it's not legitimate. But what's conflicting is that Malcolm Turnbull's website, where he's got an FAQ about the policies, says that it is not illegal under the Copyright Act.
Well, I think region locking, which is the old term for geo-blocking, region locking was explicitly outlawed in the 90s in Australia because of just before DVDs. And so it was never illegal to have a different region DVD in Australia.
Yes.
It was just never particularly enforced. And I think that's the hangover from that.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because when you think about it, if I'm sitting in America, I'm allowed to watch Hulu, according to... depending which side of the fence you're on, but when I'm outside of America, I'm not. So what happens if I've got a video camera, a web camera pointing to a TV set, or pointing to a computer that's running Hulu?
Well, poor, but
that computer's
poor quality,
sitting in America. That's true. Okay, that's not a good way to bypass it. The CEO of ARIA did say that there needs to be a three-pronged approach to make it easier for people to do the right thing by investing in legal services, educate people on those services, and make it harder for people to access illegal services, which would be great. So why doesn't Netflix offer the same range of content here in Australia that it does elsewhere?
And that's where I think licensing and things like that need to come in place. So it's probably not really a VPN issue as such. It's probably more about licensing and doing things that you need to do so that people can have access to the data.
But following the old model of licensing for as long as possible, because that's the most in terms of maximizing revenue for them.
Yes.
And they're going to go screaming and kicking into the, we will license once and allow everybody to have it through that one license. And, you know, really it's a case of I will do as much as I can for as long as I can.
Yes.
Yeah. So, anyway, we shall see, won't we? We are sitting at 18 minutes to 6, and we're going to be coming back with Valve and some gaming news.
Technogaze.
This is Technogaze with Michael, Nicole, and Luke. Luke, this is your segment.
All right, I'm going to talk computer games, and I know not everybody is a big gamer or whatever, so please
I love games.
Feel free to ask questions. Or
I will ask questions because I put up my hand to say I know very little.
I think this was a really interesting thing happened during the week, and so try and get through it. So, you know, computer games, you play them, they're humorous, there's art, you know, action, all that sort of stuff, but there's sort of a subculture that's developed over the last 30 years called modding.
Right.
What's it's nothing
that?
To do with Vespers. It's all to do with the games themselves. It's where, you know, you can alter the game as a hobby.
So how do you get to alter the source code of a game?
Well, many games come with the source code, or they come with the art in a little subdirectory or anything. So, you know, you can just go in and change it, and then your change will appear in the game when start it back up.
So is this only for PCs?
No, it's got a long history in most things, but it's very common in the PC because the tools come, you know, the tools come with the computer to do that sort of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And but can you do it on, like, Xbox dedicated consoles or not?
You can. It's not a...
Or to a lesser extent.
To a lesser extent, because it's a lot more locked down, those sorts of things.
Okay.
And, you know, and so modding, traditionally it's used to, you know, add new characters or new levels or change the way, fix bugs is a very common one. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a game that you love has some bug in it, but it's no longer supported. Someone will just fix the bug and then they share that fix. And so that's a mod.
Okay, so it's almost like this open source
community
for but, of course, you know, it's legally grey issue because it's very unofficial, it's hobbyists, it's fans of the game.
Yep.
So you're doing it for love.
Yeah, absolutely for love. And it can be, the quality can vary a lot, and the intent. So even if it's a very serious game, like a sort of a high fantasy game with like elves and orcs, some modder could do something cheeky like replace the dragons with, you know, Thomas the Tank Engine. So no. You'll be playing and then all of a sudden...
How about a couple of minions? No kidding.
Yeah, yes, yes. Well, no, well, you kid, but you it's, it happens. And of course, it's very queer-friendly because there's not much queer content in games, and so the community makes their own queer content and, you know, better-looking characters, or a common one is to add or remove moustaches from the characters in a game just because people like moustaches on their characters. And, and so it's, you know, it's overwhelmingly fans doing it and sharing it out of love.
Yeah.
But then during the week, a company called Valve, who run an online PC gaming store, the largest one called Steam, they added a little side store to their main service where you could sell mods. And for the first time, they sort of monetized this community effort.
So if I wrote the mod, would I put it up there and sell it and they would get a percentage like Apple does and Google and so on?
So is it, it would be split three ways between Valve, the company that made the game, and the person that did the mod.
Oh, okay. And so the company that made the game also got a bit
in
of...
In fact, so they get 25% or something.
Well, I think the company sets the figure themselves.
Right.
Right, okay.
The share. And so they opened up this little side store, and within 4 days, they shut it down. Because the public outcry and outrage, as they said, the store itself was profitable, but the bad will was costing us millions of dollars across the rest of the company. And it was just the biggest problems with it, as it turned out, was that the profit sharing, the modders were only getting 25%. But of course, like, how much money should they get modding someone's game who spent all the time and money making the original game?
That's right.
You know, so no one was quite sure what a fair value for that was.
And how do you enforce quality control? You know, how do you tell if it's a good mod or a bad mod? Could you get your money back?
Well, you can get a refund for 24 hours, I think, but after that you're on your own.
Oh, but if it takes longer to play through the whole game, then it might start off really good.
Buyer beware. And of course, if a new version of the game comes out, an official version, that breaks compatibility with the mod, who's responsible for that?
True.
That no one knew. And the lawyers were like, well, maybe Valve, because they sold it, maybe the modder, but it was just...
Sounds like it was a bit complicated.
It was very complicated, but I think the main thing out of it was that the community resented kind of being monetized in this way. And Forbes magazine described it as turning friends into food.
Right.
Because, you know, these mods, they're hobbyists, they love the game, they love everything about it, and then all of a sudden money enters the equation and, you know...
It just ruins it.
Yeah. Yes, yeah.
And it's, they've been doing it for so long, 30 years is a long time to have this tradition that, I can imagine the outcry on it.
You don't mess lightly, I guess.
Yeah, and it was purely for Valve wanting to make a dollar.
Oh, you know, Valve... It's got a double-edged sword with the gaming community because it is sort of the indie that made good. It wasn't one of the big publishers.
Right.
But it's just grown and grown and grown. It is now it's the gatekeeper for PC games.
Uh-huh.
And so people love it but hate it. It's a classic...
Have they sold out? Haven't they sold out argument?
Exactly.
Be interesting if they actually did some research around what, you know, could potentially be down the track.
Well, when they withdrew the service after 4 days, they did a mea culpa, mea coupla. I can never get that right.
mea culpa, I think, yes.
Yeah, and they said, oh, we just put it out there. We thought it was a cool idea, but clearly we blundered. We blundered into something we didn't really understand, and we hope you'll forgive us. And
it was only 4 days, so I'm sure they'll forgive.
Yeah. But 4 days in internet time is a very long time.
And I think 4 days in the memories of gamers is also going to be a very, very long time.
Well, people are looking for reasons to hate Valve sometimes.
Do you think that somebody else may try to start up another PC distribution type service?
Oh, there are others. Origin, I think, is one of the other big ones. There's a independent game developers have... A group of them in the US. It's come out of the Gamergate thing a bit.
Right.
I think it's called Itch.io. And it's for the games Valve doesn't want to touch. Like, you know, smaller, like feminist games or pansexual games and things like that. The quirkier stuff.
So. Oh, okay. And so Valve, what, actively looks at games, says I won't sell them?
It's pretty complicated, I guess. But there's a gatekeeping process called Greenlight, where you propose putting your game on Steam mm-hmm. and people vote up or down. And, you know, it's 30 million people who are very mainstream. Mm. And so the more indie games really struggle to get through that process. And so a group of them have decided to just bypass it and kind of do like a punk version of Valve, of Steam.
What's the downside for Valve just putting everything up?
Well, the value in Steam is that it's curated a bit.
Oh, okay. So we only have the good stuff and we won't. Yeah, okay, I understand.
Their level is very low. They let my game in, so their standards can't be
too
high.
Oh,
no. I'm sure your game is very good. I have not played it
because
I can't play games, but I'm sure it's very good.
Let people know about it if you like.
Yes. So you mentioned Gamergate.
Yes.
Yes. What was Gamergate?
You know, what isn't Gamergate? Okay. It was basically just a backlash against, I guess, queer and alternative voices and female voices in gaming.
Right.
Just, you know, because there's been a lot of debate over the last few years in the gaming community about representation of mm-hmm. people. Because it's, even though it's a very new field of art, it's actually probably the most conservative compared to film and television and books.
It's strange that, isn't it? Because it is new. You would think that it would be, but I guess the players are coming from a certain background.
And also game developers are very conservative in what they do because I think they're on the edge, they're pushing new technologies, and so they go, well, we can't, not everything can be new. We have to kind of, to let people actually understand what we're doing, we need to kind of resort to some staples.
Right.
You know, and so it's all very, you know, sci-fi and fantasy and that. And yeah, so some people who are outspoken about that started getting attacked online.
Right.
And it's coalesced into this movement called Gamergate. It's unfortunate because perhaps there's a kernel to what they're saying, but the language they use and the company they keep is so despicable you can't even get to that first step of the conversation.
Right.
You know, because they do this thing called doxing. So some prominent feminists, they hack into their accounts, you know, they get death threats, they try and get them fired, you know, all these sorts of things. And you're like, well, we can't even listen to what you're saying until you're being civil.
Right.
Yeah, so it's unfortunate, Gamergate.
Okay. Now, there's a gaming convention.
Oh, speaking of representation of queer people in gaming. So about, it's all kind of in the same melting pot, the same stew. So about 3 years ago, a group of people in San Francisco kickstarted a gaming convention for queer people called GamerX. It was quite popular.
Mm-hmm.
It came, and they've done three of them, or they've done two, the third one's coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And the word on the street, this is a bit fresh, so don't 100% not quote me on this. Not locked in.
Not locked in.
The word on the street is they're coming to Australia early next year. So
that would be good.
Interesting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it'd be the first time it's held outside the USA. And
Do you know when and where?
I've heard Sydney around Mardi Gras time.
Makes sense.
Mm. Yeah, it does. It could be quite the party.
Would you be going if it's there up in Sydney?
You know, I've never been to Mardi Gras. Have either of you been?
Yes.
I went this year for the first time and I sat inside a room pressing buttons on the audio panel for the broadcast. But were you out in the street?
Yes, definitely. Yeah. It's such a great party and, you know, what it represents. So it's certainly certainly something for everyone to do. But definitely with the GamerX, it sounds like if it is going to happen, then I'm sure it'll change the way.
It's called GX now.
Oh,
I guess
GX.
They keep simplifying the titles.
And we will hear soon whether it's coming to Australia or not.
Yes.
Now, very briefly, Nicole, you've got a story that you wanted to talk about.
Yes, it was a story from last week that we didn't get to chat about, but it's a 102-year-old lady who actually sees herself dancing on film for the first time. And we're not saying film as in seeing it on a TV, but actually through an iPad. So,
okay.
So with technology and the way that it kind of operates, she was able to actually see herself perform as she used to, and she's 102 years old, so
which is quite a good age.
Yeah, and she's, you know, sound of mind, and she really appreciated the fact that they went out of their way to find this footage of her, and she recognized herself, and you know, she loves dancing, and it was just a really positive story around how technology can really change the way we do things.
And it shows you, it talks about accessibility, whereas once upon a time, if she had to go into a movie theater to see the old reel-to-reel film, that she wouldn't have been able to, and they can just bring it to her on an iPad. It's great.
102. Wow.
Yeah, we'll post it on the Facebook fan page for everyone to have a look.
Yeah, that should be good. It is 5 minutes to six, and you're listening to Technogaze on Joy 94.9.
Technogaze.
We are heading towards the last few minutes of Technogaze, and as usual, it's gone very, very quickly. But we thought we would talk about this next story, which is amazing. You know, when you think of Professor Stephen Hawking, you don't think that he's 73.
I know. No. I'm a bit shocked about that one.
So was I. And, you know, so we've got a relatively old man, not that old, 73-year-old, suffers from motor neuron disease. But one thing he does have is a sense of humour. Last weekend, he was at an appearance at the Sydney Opera House, and he was asked what his advice would be to for any young fans who were heartbroken because Zayn Malik left One Direction. Now, Zayn is the good-looking one you pointed out before, Luke, didn't you?
He's so dreamy.
Yes. Well, this is what Stephen Hawking said.
Finally, a question about something important. My advice to any young girl is to pay close attention to the study of theoretical physics, because one day, there may well be proof of multiple universes. It would not then be beyond the realms of possibility that somewhere outside of our own universe lies another different universe. And in that universe, Zayn is still in One Direction. This girl may even like to know that in another possible universe, she and Zayn are happily married.
Well, I think that leaves some scope for some of us to get married to Zayn as well.
Hopefully.
In other universes.
Time to invent parallel universe hopping.
See, we've got humanoids, we've got parallel universes, we've got all sorts of things.
Yep, indeed. Now, we, of course, have run out of time, but if you've missed any part of the show or perhaps you're looking to listen to previous episodes, you can do so by going to joy.org.au/technogaze. Nicole, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And Luke, thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
And the news at six is next with Michael, followed by Dick with a Touch of Pink, whose single of the week is the cover of Suzanne Vega's Tom's Diner. Have a great weekend, and we will catch you next week.
Technogaze on Joy 94.9.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.